And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I recorded a video this week with Chris and Daryl, and it is different than this podcast. We focused on the questions that came in regarding the seven portfolios that were covered in one of the eight articles that we produced as part of our investor boot camp. And I just, since most of you will not see that video, and the reason I say that is because as I look back at the series of articles, podcasts, and videos, here's the bottom line. We've had about 180,000 people open the articles at MarketWatch. We had about 80,000 people open the eight podcasts that went along and discussed the same topics as those eight articles. And then we had about 28,000 people watch the videos that discussed those eight topics. So the first thing is that the articles are seen by a lot more people. Now, what is interesting about that is that I get a report that tells me what was the average period of time that those people spent on those articles. And it is rarely more than 2 minutes each. Those articles typically take about less than 6 minutes to read. Now, I compare that to the misery that you have to go through to sit through a podcast, and it is a far greater challenge to get people to sit for 45 minutes or an hour. And then a video becomes even tougher because now not only is it going to be long, but I've got to sit somewhere to watch it. So we understand there are huge differences, but I do want to encourage you to watch this recent piece that we did. I will just give you a hint of a few of the things that we covered. In fact, I'll even just take a second, if I might, and talk about a couple of them, because I know that most of you are not going to watch the video. One thing I thought was kind of interesting, a surprise, as this video was about answering questions regarding the different portfolios we recommend. But we were talking about the use of combinations of U.S. and international, comparing the 50-50 U.S. international with the 70-30, and we have two different tables to reflect those returns. But, in fact, I'll make sure that along with this video that we include links to those two tables, because if you haven't seen the 70-30 table, I think you'll find it interesting. But what did come up that was interesting to me is that Chris's daughter has introduced us to a new combination of U.S. and international. Now, we all know the two-fund strategy using, well, first of all, there's Chris's two-fund strategy that is a combination generally of a target date fund and small cap value. Then there's another two-fund strategy, and that is the S&P 500 with a small cap value, let's say 50-50. Well, what Chris's daughter has done is keep it 50-50 large cap blend and small cap value, but it's 70% U.S. and 30% international. So in that 30% international, it's 15% international large cap blend and 15% small cap, again, international small cap value. And another topic that we discussed on that video had to do, it was a response to a fellow who had chided us a little, being a bit critical that we were such geniuses to have found the best combinations of assets going back to 1970. And of course, it's true. We always know what we should have done. But then at some level, that's how we all make the decisions, based on something we learn from the past. The question is, are we learning legitimate information from the past? If we look at 5 or 10 years of performance, is that statistically meaningful? Well, the academics would say, no, it is not. But it did pose an interesting question. We have this study that starts in 1970 through 2022. And we know that small cap value was by far the best. But what would the case be if you actually looked at what happened from 1928 to 1969? So that was what you would have used to make your decisions. And it is different. Now, there's a reason. It's important to understand why there is a difference. But here is the difference. We know over the last 53 years, small cap value outproduced small cap blend by a substantial amount, and small cap blend performed better than large cap value, and large cap value better than large cap blend. And the reason that's so is because the growth has been the underachiever long term, whether it's small or large. But here is what we do know about those four major asset classes we typically talk about to make up the U.S. four fund strategy. When you look from 1928 to 1969. Now, this is the information, theoretically, you're going to use to tell people what to do in the future. Small did a whole bunch better than large. That was the winner. When we look at 1970 to 2022, really the winner is value versus growth. But back then, the big advantage was small versus large. For example, large cap blend compounded at about 9.5%, large cap value 9.2%. Small cap blend compounded at 11.5%, small cap value 11.3%. So you made about 2% more in small and blend and small value than you would have gotten in large cap blend and large cap value. But there was not the advantage to small cap value. Part of that comes because during that period from 1928 until 1969, well, in fact, during the period from 1928 to 1933, the value stocks just got creamed. Now, remember what value is basically, there are companies that are out of favor. And so if you look at what happened to companies out of favor, they really became out of favor during the Depression, because you know there is a suggested weakness, sometimes financial weakness, in the value companies. And so it is not unexpected that when you have a catastrophic kind of a decline like we had during an economy during that period of time, that value, both small and large, will way underperform. But if we look at the period from just small cap value, If we look at the period from 1928 to 1969, the compound rate of return for small cap value is 11.2. If we cut out those horrible few years, 29, 30, 31, 32, and we look from beyond 1932 through 1969, it's a 17.2% compound rate of return. So the bottom line is that evaluating performance can be pretty doggone tricky. And by the way, I am excited to share with you that Daryl Balls has done some really interesting work going back to 1928. He won't let me show you all the tables yet because he wants to make sure everything is right, but I got a hold of him, and I'm just going to share, if I might, a couple of stories that I learned going back to 1928. I looked at the period from 1928 to 1937. That was a period that by the end of, if you put $1,000 to work in beginning of 1928, you ended up by 10 years later with zero return. You had what you put in still, but there wasn't any return on it. It was worth $1,000. Interestingly enough, that wasn't terrible in those days because you had deflation rather than inflation. So you hadn't lost the buying power that you would during a period of increasing inflation. So you compare what happened to the S&P 500 during that 10-year period, assuming a lump sum investment at the beginning of the period, you compare that to what you would have left in the small cap value, and at the end of that 10 years, you would have $750 left instead of the $1,000 the S&P 500 had. So it was a much, much better period for a lump sum investment. But if instead you looked at a dollar cost averaging investment, and you put $100 a year over the 10 years into the S&P 500 and $100 a year into the small cap value over that 10-year period, you would have actually had with the S&P 500 about $1,130. And with the small cap value, $1,152. You actually came away with a small profit because of the dollar cost averaging during the market that was down so much in the early 30s. And something else I learned that I'll be looking more carefully at, and that is the relationship between small cap value and large cap value. There are a number of people have asked me in going to the two fund strategy where you have the S&P 500. And by the way, the S&P 500 is going to own virtually all of the large public companies. So there is no question that it represents a major part of the U.S. economy, and the small cap value is going to be a very small percentage of the U.S. economy in terms of the price per share and the number of shares in the different kinds of companies. So The S&P 500 is typically driven by a relative handful of those companies. Maybe 50 out of the 500 will drive most of that performance. But here's something that I find very interesting. And it gives me a sense of comfort in having somebody really get the value premium by having the small cap value by itself rather than having to have the large cap value as a part of that value holding. So I looked at all of the years going back to 1928, and I looked at each year, and I was looking at the performance of large cap value and small cap value in each of those years. That's a total of 95 years. And by the way, in those 95 years, the market was down 23. So it's about one out of 4 years the market is down. And we also know that the average loss, I believe, is around 14-15% for the market over those 23 losing years. But how did large cap value and small cap value do during the down years? Well, in that one out of 4 years approximately, small cap was better than large cap value, small cap value better than large cap value in 7 years, and large cap value was better than small cap value in 16 years. So what that says is about 30% of the years the market is down, small cap value does better than large cap, and about 70% of the time when the market is down, large cap value does better than small cap. So advantage large cap value during the down years, but the down years are only about a quarter, less than a quarter of the years. So then we look at the up years. And what we find is that small cap value is better than large cap value in 50 of those 72 years, about 69% of the time. I mean, they're generally both up. There'll be a few exceptions, but in most cases when the market is up, they're going to be both are going to be up. And small cap value did better in 50 out of 72, and large cap value did better than small cap value in 22 out of the 72 up years. So just the opposite, approximately about 70% advantage large cap value in the bad years and a 70% advantage almost to small cap value in the good years. And that has created, when you look at the compound rate of return of the small cap value, about a 3% plus advantage. And there's lots more to come out of these new tables, and I am excited to share them with you. It is only appropriate to do it when we have Daryl there to talk about the information. He's done such a great job for our foundation and helping you become more knowledgeable as an investor, remembering that the goal here is to make you as a do-it-yourself investor taking care of the most important portfolio in the world, your own, that you do it with as much information as you possibly can. And the reason that is important is because when you're really, I'll use the word indoctrinated, when you really understand what the past looks like, you are so much more likely to stay the course. You know, one of the reasons a professional advisor is paid the big bucks they are is that it is their job to keep their clients in that portfolio, in that strategy, hoping that the future will look like the past, and those bear markets will turn into bull markets. Well, you have the same responsibility, except you're trying to do it for yourself and for your family. And that makes it complex, because you are arguing with yourself that you got to stay the course when you know there are so many things around you that make you uncomfortable. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make you into a really hard-hearted, well-educated investor that knows to stay the course through thick and thin. And at the other end of the spectrum, to know enough about the downside to know how to defend against the downside when it happens by having the right amount of fixed income. That's what all these tables are about, is to make you as professional as we possibly can. So I know this is a relatively short, I know what I want to talk about before I leave. I've had a fair amount of feedback about the piece I did on Dave Ramsey in the newsletter. I don't know if you're a newsletter reader, but if you are, you probably didn't miss the situation of the story about Dave Ramsey and this huge lawsuit that he has to defend against. And part of the problem is that he has to deal with the conflicts of interest when people are paying you to recognize them as a good or great advisor. And I really think I know what the solution is for Dave Ramsey, and I mean this I don't know how much older I am than Dave. I've got a son who's 58. And so I suspect Dave Ramsey may be a few years older than that, but here would be my fatherly advice. I think it's great that you've taken the time to recognize advisors that you trust. What I don't think is great is that those advisors make their living selling, and I don't know this is true of all of them, but a lot of them, they sell loaded funds. And there are all sorts of reasons why I don't like loaded funds. It isn't just about the load. It is that loaded funds typically are actively managed. Actively managed funds typically pay a lot more in turnover costs. Actively managed funds, and Morningstar breaks this out, if you want to learn how to track this, you can actually go into the price link above a mutual fund page on Morningstar, and it will tell you how much taxes would be paid on the taxable portion of the earnings that the fund generated. And typically, it's about a 1% lower return overall with actively managed funds than it is with index funds. So you've got a load versus no load. You've got higher taxes versus lower taxes. You have more diversification with the index fund. Now, the reason that I'm making a big deal about active versus passive is because most of the actively managed funds are loaded, and not all, but many. And what I think that Dave should be doing, if he wants people to pay him to recommend them, that's fine. But have another category. Have that category be people who work for investors on an hourly basis and don't take a commission. And almost all of those people do their work using index funds. Now, that would then allow Dave, I mean, he says index funds are okay. He doesn't say they're bad, but when he's directing all of his folks to people who specialize in active management, you know, that's a little bit of a tricky subject. How do you deal with that and how you present the possible avenues that an investor could take? But if he would extend that same service, allow people to be on his list. Now, they're going to have to pay, but I'm going to say that for the people who are the hourly advisors, they probably make one quarter what the people who work with load funds do. One quarter. Maybe it's one-tenth of the money. And so whatever the fee is to be a member of the club, I would just want to, on behalf of those hourly advisors, I would want to see them pay less to be on the list. But I really do believe that we should give people the choice. I am going to be interviewing some advisors in the coming months. Some advisors will be full service advisors who get a percentage of the assets under management, AUM. Some will be people who charge purely by the hour. Some will be people who don't work on a percentage of assets under management, but they work on a project basis, or maybe some of them charge an hourly fee. They're all legitimate ways to help people. But my belief is that the people I'm going to call it the lower income group, and I'm not suggesting that these are poor people. I'm just saying that people who are young investors who are just getting started and don't have a lot of money in the market, they want to keep all they can working for them. So they need to minimize the costs of management, not maximize it. So I'm hoping that somebody who follows Dave will say, Merriam has got an idea that you might want to consider. And that is, yes, direct people to advisors out there in the field and give people a choice. And that would be not only a choice between commissions or not, but it would be between active management or indexing. And there are just too many smart people who believe in indexing not to give the people you're trying to help be smart that avenue as well. So that's my end of my tirade on Dave Ramsey. I know that he is famous for helping people get out of debt. And I think that's great. I do have a difference of opinion, and so do a lot of other people who have either been advisors or are advisors in the how you should pay off your debts, and they disagree with his strategy. But he's made it work for a lot of people. I'm happy for those people, but I want their investing. I want their investing to be as efficient and as profitable as it can be. Let's have all the advice they get be the very best that's available. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your questions. Thanks for sharing the free copy of We're Talking Millions and Two Funds for Life. We're putting together a page of free books in the coming months, which will not only be free books from our organization, but free books from other people in the industry that I believe are trying to help investors do better on their own. Thanks again. Be well. And by the way, I hope this information all helps you have a better financial future. Good luck.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.